The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
If you are passionate about food and how it supports well-being and health, learn more. The Institute for Optimum Nutrition has been training nutritional therapists for 35 years on its highly acclaimed and accredited diploma courses. Start your new career in nutritional therapy, one that will make a difference and help others achieve their health goals. Train with the home of nutritional therapy education. Find us online and give us a call or click on the IOM banner on the UK Health Radio homepage.
Hello and welcome to Talk Fertility, a show where we do just that, talk about fertility. I'm Natalie Silverman, host of the Fertility Podcast, which I launched in 2015, once successfully pregnant after having fertility treatment.
And I'm Kate Davis, a trained fertility nurse and founder of Your Fertility Journey, where I work one-to-one with women and couples to help them understand and optimise their fertility.
Our guest today is a lady who I've spoken to before on the podcast, I've also worked with, because she's doing such a range of work within the fertility space. Her name is Jessica Hepburn, and I know Kate is also really looking forward to talking to Jessica, aren't you?
I am. I'm a big fan of Jessica's, and I'm really excited to hear more about her Everest challenge, because like Jessica, I share a love of climbing and mountains, but I can only, you know, dream of doing quite as much as Jessica has done so far. But yeah, I'm really excited to hear more.
I'm loving learning more about you. Never really imagined you on a mountain, so we'll have to talk more about that.
What's that supposed to mean?
Not in a bad way. I just hadn't thought of it. That's all.
I camped on the edge of a mountain, I'll have you know.
Well, learn something new every day about your co-host. There you go. Kate and I aren't in the same place when we record these chats. We do it by the power of technology. And it's always quite fascinating to get these little insights as we get to know each other a bit better. So enjoy this conversation with Jessica. If you haven't heard about her before, you, I think, will be quite taken aback at what she is doing in the fertility space. If you are aware of Jessica, I'm sure you'll be pleased to hear an update, because she's not long back down from a mountain. So we were lucky to have caught up with her. So enjoy the show.
The only problem is a bit of my headset got lost on the mountain, so it's a bit of feedback.
You know what? If we do an interview with you without a headset and there's a bit of feedback, and the reason is because it got lost on a mountain in Russia, it's totally allowed.
That's good.
It's on the south side of Mount Elbrus somewhere.
So we're now going to welcome to the show a friend and fertility warrior, adventurer, just general, totally
good
busy
egg
lady and heroic person within the fertility world, Jessica Hepburn, to our show. It's very hard to do a good introduction to Jessica because it's so extensive. So what we're going to do is just bring her in and get chatting. Welcome, Jessica. How are you?
God, this is such a build-up, Natalie. I'm not going to be able to live up to it. Yeah,
I've heard other build-ups. I mean, they're getting longer as the achievement. Just to put it into perspective, since I've known Jessica, which has probably been about 5 years, she's swum the channel. She's put on an epic fertility festival over a number of years that is now global. What we're going to hear about is her preparations for climbing Everest. And whenever I talk to Jessica and I ask whether you're getting much sleep, I mean, I like that you are managing to sleep, probably from exhaustion, because the brain is in such overdrive.
Everything combined is all-consuming. It's true.
Well, let's start with Fertility Fest, because this year was epic for Fertility Fest. And forgive me if you don't know what we're talking about. It's a festival that Jessica will explain more about. And there's lots of other podcast episodes within the Fertility Podcast that I will make sure you can share. This year, it had a one-month programme at the Barbican. And I want to talk a bit more about your main objective for it, Jessica, and whether you met it.
Yeah. It was the third, the biggest, and I think probably the best festival we've done. I mean, the background to Fertility Fest is that for many years, alongside my sort of struggle to become a mother going through 11 rounds of IVF, I ran a big theatre in London. Then I wrote a book about, which is called The Pursuit of Motherhood, about my IVF journey. And as a result of that, other artists, theatre artists, dancers, musicians, filmmakers, writers, visual artists, started to contact me and tell me about the work that they were making. And so the festival sort of basically brought together my arts producing background with my fertility background to create, you know, what we call the world's first arts festival dedicated to fertility, infertility, the science of making babies and modern families. This year it was huge because it was at the Barbican for 3 weeks. We've also developed a relationship with the Fertility Show, the biggest patient event in the UK. We've been in Manchester and we're going to London at the end of the year. And we've also been in Vienna at ESHRE, the biggest fertility industry conference in the world. And the aim of the festival is like simply to use the stories made by artists about their fertility journeys to try and improve the world of fertility. And particularly we want to improve fertility education, we want to improve patient emotional and mental health care, and also just raise all levels of discourse about reproductive science. It's been a huge year, yes.
It has been.
Scattered around that, she's been swimming, doing open water swimming in various countries, as well as preparing for Everest, which we'll move on to.
You're superwoman.
I just always say, like, all this came out of a lot of pain, and it would have been so much easier if I'd just been able to have a baby. But I wanted to turn what I went through into something positive for me and for other people. And the thing about the challenges, swimming the channel, running the marathon, yeah, as you say, climbing Everest, is that like these are huge mental and physical endurance challenges that are sort of very similar to going through IVF. And I sort of want the world to understand, you know, what it is like to struggle to conceive and go through fertility treatment. And doing these challenges hopefully raises awareness of that.
So we know that the Fertility Fest was absolutely incredible. The feedback that I heard was amazing. What was the best bit of feedback that you got, and who was it from? Was it from somebody going through a fertility journey, or was it from kind of the fertility industry?
It's so difficult, Kate, to single out one piece of feedback. I think when we first piloted Fertility Fest, which is a few years ago now, I think the thing that was really special about it is that it created the first ever platform for patients, and many of the artists are people who've been on their own fertility journeys, not all of them, but patients and the public and the profession, a sort of level playing field to sort of discuss, you know, what it feels like to go through treatment. And I think patients are often very vulnerable in the face of professionals, in the face of doctors who hold their happiness in their hands. And so what it's done, and you know, it's a sort of unique alchemy, is it's enabled them to have a sort of a two-way conversation, you know, for the first time. So I would say that the best pieces of feedback, the two best pieces of feedback we get are when professionals say to us, as a result of being involved in Fertility Fest and hearing the voices of the patients that they work with, that their practice is going to change as a result. And we heard that over and over again. So that means so much. And, you know, I think, you know, things like, you know, I never want to say that Fertility Fest is the single reason that things have been changing, because I think there's a movement of change. But like things like the male experience being much more sort of talked about now, and the sort of the need for clinical treatment to go hand in hand with emotional support and mental health care, you know, those are huge shifts that we have seen since I was going through treatment myself. And I think we've played a part in that, in really opening up, you know, to the profession, that, you know, the need for support in these areas. And so that's one thing. But then that is totally balanced with when patients come to Fertility Fest And they send and give us such amazing feedback about the thing we hear over and over again, I no longer feel like I'm alone. Because going through infertility and fertility treatment is a really often for many people a very isolating experience. And actually coming together with others and realizing you are not alone. You are one amongst many people. Everyone's story is different, but you are one amongst many people is also a wonderful thing that we've done. And before we had things like Fertility Fest, patients were congregating online, and that is a really important space. But there's nothing like being in the same room as other people who understand, who care, who are sharing. There's something really special about that.
I mean, I completely agree with you, kind of going back to what you're saying there about patient experiences informing professionals' practice. Without doubt, the experiences of my patients, and also I've made it my mission to immerse myself in as much reading about the patient experience, hence I've read both of your books, also listening to podcasts, so I can really understand the patient journey and really appreciate it so that I can support my patients better.
It's an ongoing process. But whilst I said that, like, everyone's fertility story is different, and one of the really complex things about the world of fertility today is that there is no one size patient. There are people going through fertility treatment who have got infertility diagnoses and people who have got no fertility problems at all. You know, like, everyone looks different, but there are many similarities about the experience. Isolation being one of them, you know, that feeling that you don't know how your story is going to end, or how, you know, that if it doesn't end in the way that you hope it's going to end, whether you will be able to, you know, like, whether you'll be able to find happiness. You know, that's a sense of sort of jealousy or envy amongst peers who are getting, you know, think this easily, you know, feeling that somehow you're not a natural normal woman or a natural normal man. You know, these are sort of common symptoms of the experience of going through infertility and fertility treatment, because of course, even if you're not infertile, fertility treatment doesn't work every time for everyone. And so, you know, you're often having to deal with the heartbreak of unsuccessful treatment. There are some very common feelings that everyone shares. And if we can sort of work out what those are and then put the support in place to help people through that, not least just making them realize that that is totally common. They are not the only one feeling that. I think things will improve.
I mean, having been privileged to be at the original Fertility Fest and then how it's grown over the years, things that I've witnessed as somebody who's been a participant and have obviously worked with you, Jessica, is first and foremost, when you talk about the space that you've created, the size shift from that very first year to the Barbican is massively significant, yet the feeling within the room was as welcoming and warming. And I think that that was truly unique. And we talk about the online community, of course, being so vital in this, but like you say, being in the same place as people and in the different spaces that I was in the different environments and the different conversations, it was there. And that is something that is testament to what you've created. Personally, the fascination of watching experts thinking on their feet and maybe being challenged a little bit more bravely by people than people might have done in individual consultations, because there was that kind of group mentality, and it was quite amazing to see. And like you say, the clinics have responded and come away with so much. The whole emotive nature of it has been such a precious thing that now when I talk to people in a wider space, Fertility Fest is as known a thing as we mentioned the fertility show. I think it's totally done it this year in how it's now understood, it's referred to, it's a part of the conversation that is being had about what we need to do with fertility, because it's been talked about a lot in the mainstream press, probably more so this year than before, and I think it's just become a more normal part as a result of, I think, what went on.
If that's what we've achieved, then that's a dream come true. We often describe it as walking into a hug. you know, like you're walking into like a warm place where people understand, but also it can be quite a challenging space, and that's important too. And you've referred to professionals thinking on their feet, because, you know, sometimes there's a sort of uprising from the audience, which was, hold on a minute, like, why do we not know this information? You know, it's partly because this is a science that is evolving all the time, and we're finding a language to talk about it as we live it, and partly because, you know, there hasn't really been patient power before. And I do think that that is changing, and I hope that we have been a part of that. You know, like, your podcast is part of that too. You know, you're a patient yourself, so we're part of a collective of patient advocates that are doing different things. And, you know, it's brilliant when we're able to work together to try and make the industry that is serving us better. And I hope we are. And I think also, you know, what is brilliant is that I mainly feel that the industry feel that we are, but even those that might like not feel that have to listen to us, because we're becoming a really, really strong voice.
You've said that much. That's what I was trying to say. You said it better.
No, not at all.
Let's talk about the challenge side of what you do. Kate referred to your two books. The most recent book, 21 Miles, was written whilst you were training to swim the Channel. The latest challenge is going to Everest next year, 2020, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Fingers crossed.
And you're not long back from Russia, where Jessica actually confessed to losing part of her headphones, which was completely allowed. Let's just talk a bit about why Everest.
I know, it was because the night before summit, and I was listening to my headphones to try and calm myself down, and I've lost them. They're
well, I hope you felt calm.
Yeah, I did, but I didn't feel calm after I realised I'd lost them. But anyway, it's fine. That's a whole other story.
Tell us about the climb you've just been on.
Yeah, I've had this crazy week because I've been working on this mountain madness for the last few years. I am in the final stages of preparation now, and actually I'm going to climb my final biggest sort of training challenge in September, my first 8,000 meter peak. And once you go over 8,000 meters, I mean, Everest is 8,800 meters. And the best training to make sure you're ready for Everest is to climb over 8,000 meters. And I need to really be in the best shape of my life. I have just climbed last week Elbrus, which is the highest mountain in Europe. It's about the same height. Everyone knows Kilimanjaro. It's about the same height of Kilimanjaro, but sort of more, a slightly more technical mountain.
As you know, I'm quite nerdy about mountains as well, although all I've climbed is Kilimanjaro, and it was amazing. It was one of the best experiences of my life.
Don't say all and Kilimanjaro in the same sentence.
No. Yes.
Well,
Kilimanjaro is a massive mountain.
It was amazing. I loved it, and I'm desperate to do more, which is why I'm so intrigued in all of this. So how did that differ when you said it was more of a technical challenge, which I'm sure it was, but you know, how did it differ?
With Kilimanjaro, you're not really walking on snow.
No.
And you don't, it's more like a trek. And whereas Elbrus, you get onto snow sort of beyond the sort of high camp. And so you're on crampons with ice axe on ropes. You don't experience that so much on Kilimanjaro, but
no,
Kilimanjaro is a big mountain. My craziness this week is I summited Elbrus on Wednesday, and then I flew back to the UK on Thursday, and on Friday I was on a train up to the Lake District, and I swam Windermere on Sunday.
Oh my
which
God,
was nine
Jessica.
And a half hours.
I don't understand how you did that. When I came back from Killy, I literally
understand.
Had to sit on the sofa, I think, for about 3 days. A, because one of my ankles, only one, really odd, was completely swollen. The other one wasn't, so it was really bizarre. I don't know why. But I couldn't move. I felt like my feet had fallen off. They were in that much pain. So how on earth have you done all of that?
I don't know. The thing is that this whole... So I swam the Channel in 2015, and actually this, what I call this mountain madness, started a few months later, because everyone said to me after I swam the Channel, right, you
what
know,
next?
You must not think about another... Well, they said you mustn't think about another challenge. But within a couple of weeks, I had booked to climb Kilimanjaro.
Yeah.
And I went off Kilimanjaro, and I was sort of... I think, so fit from the Channel Swim that I sort of loved it, like you did, Kate. I loved climbing it. And that was where the idea sort of set in. Like, what about, I think about a mountain challenge? And that's also when I found out that no woman has yet completed what is known as the Pond to Peak challenge, which is swimming the English Channel and climbing Everest, which are the two sort of probably most iconic physical and mental endurance challenges in the world. Wow. And, you know, in terms of their history and their sort of recognition in the public eye. And that's also what makes them sort of really, really effective in raising awareness of the struggle to conceive and the similarities. So I then sort of set out and thought, well, what if I could become the first woman to do these two challenges? And I haven't rushed it at all, because it is, you know, part of the joy is the journey. And so I've been sort of climbing mountains over the last few years working towards Everest. But I had always had in my mind that when I swam the Channel, I was so sort of fit that Kilimanjaro had been sort of a nice little jaunt for me. So why don't I try and do another big swim, mainly to get fit. But it's just sort of by fate happened that I ended up doing these two things days apart, which is totally crazy. But I'm standing and I'm feeling pretty good today, so this is all good for a 48-year-old woman.
I'm hoping you're having some kind of restorative deep tissue massage on your return and having some time out at least.
I have just been to see, I mean, this is what is wonderful about what I call the Fertility Fest family, Avni Trivedi, who is an osteopathist and who was one of did an amazing movement session at Fertility Fest this year. She said, I want you to come and have some treatment. So I've just been and had amazing treatment with her.
Oh, good.
So, and this is one of the really, really special things about this community, you know, us all sort of supporting one another. And I have to say, you know, I feel like I've had the most amazing amount of support from the fertility community with all this work, including both of you, and I'm so, so grateful for that. And it's turned something that's a, you know, really sad experience in my life that I always the first to say that I am never getting over. You know, I will carry the sadness of 11 unsuccessful rounds of IVF and not being able to have the baby in the way that I wanted with the man that I love. I will carry that with me for the rest of my life. But what I want to sort of inspire other people to do is to, you know, live big and bravely, whatever their fertility story is, and to know that there, you know, there are many ways of living life, and but also to try and support other people on their journey to help them, you know, achieve their goal of family in the happiest way that they can, or achieve their life goals, whatever that looks like. And that's sort of become the work, I guess. And yeah, it's full time.
On that theme then, and taking you back a little bit, did your interest in challenging yourself during your fertility journey, so when you started doing your challenges, did that come from a need to be able to control aspects of your life when other aspects were completely taken out of your hand?
Yeah. I mean, I'm the first to say that, and this is really true, and I know that it's difficult for people to sort of understand it when they look at what I'm doing now, but I am not an athletic, sporty type of person. I ran a theatre for many years, and, you know, I've always been an arty type of person. But coming out...
So is that lunching?
We know you like lunching.
Lots of lunching, lots of drinking, and lots of talking, lots of watching, not a lot of moving around on mountains or swimming seas.
But Jessica, I have to say, despite that might have been you, that is not you now. You are now the athletic.
No. And I think also that's about saying you can transform your life, you know, into things, and sometimes things that you never imagined were going to be your life, but are incredibly fulfilling. This definitely is for me. I feel blessed if I can inspire other people. You know, lots of people do use that word, you know, about these challenges that I do, but I always say that I'm sort of doing it for me, you know, first and foremost. I'm trying to turn the bad stuff into my life into something good, and this is how I'm doing it for me, and it has become very redemptive. But I wasn't an athletic person, and I, you know, emerged out of 11 rounds of unsuccessful IVF, age 43. I always say, whenever I sort of give talks, that I had basically lost a decade of my life to what I call Project Baby. And I didn't know what the future held, but I knew that I needed to do something different, something big, something positive. And I sort of, you know, turned to this, what had been a childhood dream, swimming the English Channel, that I hadn't even thought about for 30 years. And I started to look into what was involved. And then I was terrified because I had no idea how hard it was. But I started out on this journey. And what I didn't realize when I started was like how many parallels there were going to be with going through IVF. You know, how tough it is, to how the result is to some extent out of your control, because, and it's the same with mountains, because the sea ultimately decides whether she'll let you cross her, and the mountain decides whether she'll let you climb her, and your body, nature, decides whether she'll let you conceive and carry a baby. But it, so it sort of became like a dialogue with me and nature. And, you know, the most amazing thing was that with the channel, you know, I was blessed to succeed in crossing it, and it was, it was transformational, absolutely. And that, and then that began, you know, a path to other things.
Do you think, when you said that you have done these challenges then to make something good out of something bad and to give yourself some kind of resolution, have you got there, or are you still not quite there? And then therefore, you know, will the challenges stop because you've got there, or are they now a separate entity all by themselves?
I would say, Kate, I'm not trying to get anywhere. You know, for me, in terms of the conclusions that I've drawn about life, you know, is that it isn't linear. It isn't a sort of a path from darkness into light. You know, there are ups and downs along the way for the rest of your life. So my philosophy more is about, I'm never getting over this sadness. It will be with me forever, and new sadnesses will come and have come. But what I'm trying to do every day is go, how do I continue to put, in the short time that I'm living on this planet, good stuff in all the time, stuff that's good for me, stuff that's good for other people? Because of course people go, well, what after Everest? And at the moment I go, well, I have no idea. This is the journey I've been on the last few years. That's my goal at the moment. And that's what I'm working towards. I'm not under any illusion that once I climb Everest, then everything's fine. It's just it's a journey, and it's about putting good stuff in to replace the bad stuff that I think is part of the human condition. And my particular bad stuff is not being able to have my own biological baby with the man that I love, plus other stuff. And we all have it. We all have it.
Alongside what you're doing with the challenges and how that's making you feel, and I imagine waking up in the morning thinking about what the day holds is a pretty exhilarating thing for you, even if it is really busy. There's been the books, there's been that writing experience, and I'm interested in how cathartic that writing has been alongside the challenge of the challenge, and whether that then means there's another book coming from the Everest challenge. Because lots of people within the fertility space have talked about how blogging and journaling has helped them work stuff out and work stuff through. And obviously your first book was more related to the failed treatment side of it, the second book more related to the challenge, but still exploring all these other themes within it. Is it a cathartic process? Because it's not just something you do, just chuck out another book. It's involved as well, and then you've got the alongside it what you're trying to do mentally with the challenge.
I definitely think writing or any form of creative activity, one side of it can be a very cathartic, to use that word that you've used, as well as being sort of creative. I mean, I had never written anything, even though I've worked in the arts all my life. I've worked with artists rather than to facilitate the work of artists rather than to be an artist myself. And I had never written anything before apart from my reports for work. And then I started writing about my experience sort of principally at the time because I felt that it was a great story that we hadn't heard enough. And I thought when I started writing that I was gonna sort of be writing my way to a conventional happy ending. What I wasn't prepared for and has been a total joy is that I discovered that I absolutely loved writing. I mean, I think that now I would, cathartic or not, I would write for myself because I love it. But there is something even more extraordinary, which is when you write something and it connects with the wider world, with an audience. And that sort of, the number of messages I've had over the last few years from my first and second book, with people writing to me that have read it, that have clearly enjoyed it or been moved by it or been stimulated by it or inspired by it, that is just the most amazing feeling to know that your work, your own creative work, has connected and maybe even helped other people, inspired other people. And so the combination of loving the writing process, connecting with audiences and any catharsis that it can bring means that it is something certainly that I would like to continue to do. But I also say it's really hard bringing a book into the world, because I have lots of people contacting me now, who are trying to make their own work, whether that's books or, theatre or visual art or music or whatever, around this subject, and they're wanting to bring their work into the world. And it's really, really, really hard. It's really hard to produce the work, to find, people to get it out into the world for you, to get it out into the world yourself. So it's not an easy process, but I love it. So I will continue to do it. So I am working on a new writing project. I mean, I'm never going to be someone that churns out a book every few months. I want to write what I want to write, and so I'll take my time. But hopefully there will be another book in a few years' time, but not soon.
So can you say that there's some contentment in what's happened so far?
I would say, I want to always answer honestly, authentically. I would say my life is full of moments of contentment and moments of happiness and moments of discontentment and moments of sadness. It continues to be a continuum of all those things. But I also will say totally genuinely that I feel that I'm living the best life that I can. If I were to be run over by the proverbial bus tomorrow, or if I were to be, snowed off the mountain by an avalanche in a month's time, that you could both know and the world could know that I did everything that I wanted to do with my time on this planet. That's what drives me. In a way, the experience, the sadness of going through unsuccessful fertility treatment, has made me want to taste as much of life as I possibly can, because I'm just sort of really conscious that we're only here for a really short amount of time. And it's all those things. As I've said already, there's no movement from dark into light for me. Other people may feel differently. It's living with all those things all the time and making the most of the life I have.
One thing I just wanted to say, Jessica, I mean, I just got goosebumps there, and I think Kate and I are both getting a bit teary.
Yeah.
We spoke with Jodie Day earlier, and one of the things that she was talking about was role models. And she was talking about role models and how women without children were perceived. And it's really interesting hearing everything that you've just said. It's exactly what Jodie was just saying, you know, that there needs to be in your approach, your what you've achieved, your approach and your ethos about it all. And I think that as a legacy, as well as everything else that you've achieved, being first here and there is a certainty, because it's you can't really put it into words how it also makes other people feel. And I think never underestimate that, you know, the power of what you're doing, what you're saying, and what you've created. It's incredibly powerful.
You know, people often ask me or are confused about why I've stayed in the heart of the fertility space when the fertility industry didn't work for me, didn't do their magic for me. And, you know, that is partly because I do think if your choice is not to have children, I mean, and there's been a lot in the media recently about this, because more and more women are choosing actively not to have children. I think that's an amazing choice. But I also recognize that family, having your own family, is important for many, many people. And I'm not trying to be, if it's okay to say this, a role model for a childless life. Because I think we need family. Many people need family, or certainly human connection. And family is often the quickest route to human connection, to feel fulfilled, to feel content. So I sort of want to encourage people and help people to find ways of creating that, whilst at the same time also saying that I think people need other things as well. And also, if you can't always have the sort of, you know, the family you dreamed of or the life that you dreamed of, there are other sort of routes to happiness. And certainly these challenges have become one for me, as has writing and as has sort of creating what is often referred to as the Fertility Fest family, and which has sort of become my own family, you know, in a way. And I felt like an enormous amount, and I'm so grateful for the support that I've been given by this community that lifts me up and enables me to sort of live the best life that I can.
I mean, Jessica, one of the things that I say to my patients that are navigating a fertility journey is to take the opportunity to live your life while you're trying to conceive, or in mm-hmm. your case, you know, live your life while, I guess, finding resolution. And I think you're absolutely inspirational testament that that can be done. So despite the fact that you might not necessarily like to be put on that pedestal, you know, you are inspirational for all that you've achieved and all that you'll continue to achieve.
Thank you, Kate. But I do think it is really important that if one sort of avenue of making your family comes to a close, it doesn't mean that there aren't other avenues. And you know, in my book 21 Miles, you know, I interview a woman who had her first baby at 56 through egg donation. I interview women who've adopted children or fostered hundreds of children. I think that there are different routes to family, and some of those routes could include, you know, not actually parenting. When I swam Windermere on Sunday, I was with a woman who's 62, amazing, amazing. She swam Windermere with me at 62 years old, and she doesn't have children. Wow. I'm sort of working on this new Fertility Fest project, which is, you know, how did your fertility story make you live big and bravely, and what does family mean to you? And she said this amazing thing to me. We were having breakfast the day after the swim, and I said, what is family to you? And she said, family is my home. The home that she's creating. And I just thought that was absolutely, you know, like, we can think about family in different ways. That's what I sort of want to encourage.
I think the overriding feeling for me to you is the resilience around all of this. We won't label you with any of these different things, but what you've shown is just, I suppose, that you set your mind to something and that you can then continue, because the length of the treatment that you endured was due to having some resilience in that you carried on having the treatment, and then how you've continued on in all the other work that you've done and the challenges as well. And it just seems to me such a continued theme and strength of character.
Yeah, I don't necessarily advocate going through 11 rounds of IVF because I do think it's the extreme end of the spectrum. And, you know, I don't think there should be any competition about how many rounds of IVF you can survive. I mean, the one thing that I do want to encourage patients to know, as I've sort of crossed over from becoming a patient to, in a way, sort of working with more closely with the profession, there's sort of certain things that I just feel really important for me that the world understands. And I think a real problem is that IVF is currently seen as a sort of one treatment thing. And people, you know, think, right, I'm going through IVF, and often wrongly think it's going to work first time. And the reality is, I mean, I know it did for you, Natalie, and I know you're really lucky, but for a lot of people, it doesn't work first time. But the cumulative success rates over three or slightly more treatments are better. And so I really want to encourage people to think about, like, this is a sort of three treatment cycle. And then if it doesn't, but then there comes a point after that, when you start to go into multiple rounds of treatment where the success statistics go down. Now, that isn't to say that there aren't, you know, amazing stories like Hannah Vaughan Jones, who's just got pregnant on her 15th cycle. But I do think that, like, encouraging people to get the emotional resilience to think beyond one treatment if they need to think about, you know, around three or four treatments. And then to be, and then if it hasn't worked at that point, to then think, right, okay, should I be at that point thinking about other routes to parenthood, or am I going the duration? I'd never want people to think that 11 rounds of IVF is a good thing.
Preparing emotionally for what this journey could look like, like you've quite rightly said, having that awareness that the likelihood is that it will be multiple, not 11, but like you were saying, the three, because I was talking with somebody just the other day who was so sure that their IVF would work because of, I suppose, that narrative about it being a fix, that they were totally devastated when it didn't work, to the point that they are so traumatized by it and they can't even phone the clinic because the recorded message that they hear sends them back to that devastated place when it didn't work. And there was no discussion about the fact it might not work. And I'm with you on that. And I know it's part of the work that Kate and I want to do in the way that we're kind of, I suppose, formulating the podcast slightly, is to really have those conversations about the emotional toll. And again, like the work that, you know, you do with the support around all the Fertility Fest activity, that there is more of that conversation, because it just keeps happening.
This is absolutely, you know, like referring back to when we were talking about Fertility Fest and sort of like points when patients get angry, is that, you know, like the information is not clear enough around success rates. It's not clear enough around, you know, why does NICE recommend three rounds of treatment? You know, that's because many people will need three rounds of treatment in order to be successful, and the cumulative success rates are better. But equally, people don't necessarily know that after five rounds of treatments, your odds, partly because you're getting older and partly because there's clearly a sort of bigger issue that can't be sorted out, are starting to decrease. And I think if we could have more information around this and prepare people better, that would be really good.
Good. Great. We could continue, but we need to stop there. And there's so much more conversation to have around this, which is what Jessica is continuing to do. And we thank you for that little insight into where you're at and what's going on right now. And I know that we've got a huge amount left in the year just with the activity for Fertility Fest. You've got a Sydney trip and a London trip for the festival, haven't you?
Yeah, we're going to Sydney with the festival at the end of this month. Our big flagship show, Avalanche, starring the amazing actress Maxine Peake, is opening at the Sydney Theatre Company at the end of this month. And then we take a satellite of the festival to the Fertility Show in beginning of November. And I'll be giving two talks on the ultimate IVF survivor's guide, But also we'll have a selection of our very best Fertility Fest artists talking about their work and their journeys in dialogue with professionals and patient advocates. And I'm really looking forward to that. And then, yes, next year is the final countdown to my Everest climb and the emergence of a new Fertility Fest project, which, yeah, you'll hear more about next year. I'm sure it would be brilliant to talk to you about then. Yes.
Such a tease. Thank you so much, Jessica, and best of luck with everything that happens next.
Thank you for having me.
And please keep us informed, Jessica, on Everest. And I want to try and meet you for lunch sometime and hear more about the training.
You must do more. You must do more, Kate.
I want to.
So I've learnt you've also climbed Mount Kilimanjaro, Kate, and I'm in awe of, when I started this chat saying I didn't imagine you on a mountain, I didn't realise to quite what lengths your mountain obsession went. So you two definitely need to have a catch up. I want to climb a mountain. Maybe we need to like get something happening as a little group.
Definitely. I have to say it's one of the best experiences of my life and I wouldn't change it for the world. And there is something about, you know, when Jessica's talking, she's talking about, you know, the fact that she wants to do another challenge. And I can completely appreciate, despite, you know, not necessarily just the side of the fertility, but the fact that when you do a challenge like that, you just want to do more challenges. You really get a bug. And I definitely do have that bug. Unfortunately, I've just not done any more about it, but I will do. I do have a plan to do more.
I don't think I have got aspirations to climb Everest, to be totally honest, but I would like to do, I mean, the highest mountain I've been on is when I've skied down and that view was sensational. I would like to, you know, go a little bit higher, maybe not with the luxury of skis to get down. It may be a bit more challenge, or a ski lift to go up. It's kind of cheating, isn't it? Now, one thing that Kate and I are trying to do with the conversations that we're having, as well as bringing just fascinating people into your ear holes, is also to answer your questions. And you can get in touch, just email talkfertility@gmail.com. Kate is a medical professional. She's got decades of work within... That sounded like you're really old, didn't it? Sorry.
I'm used to it, don't worry.
She's got a lot of experience. She's got decades of experience working as a nurse and works daily with women, helping them understand more about issues affecting their fertility. And that's why we want to hear about the questions that you've got. Kate is on hand to answer them. And we like to go from the complicated to the straightforward, because no question is a stupid question. And this one is quite interesting because it's about caffeine, which we all know that we need to have in moderation, really, don't we?
We do. End of the day, caffeine is a drug. And we've had a question here about how much caffeine is safe to take when you're trying to conceive. This lady who sent the email in knows that it's not advisable once you're pregnant, and particularly in the first trimester, and then it can be drunk at minimum. But she wants to know whether it's an issue when you're trying to conceive as well. And the general guidelines is that one caffeinated drink per day is acceptable. And this can include any caffeinated drink or chocolate. Definitely, though, avoid decaf, because I think a lot of people think, right, well, I'll just switch to decaf then. But actually, the process of decaffeinating, or taking the decaf out of a caffeinated drink, uses a lot of really unhealthy substances. So we definitely say steer clear from those if you possibly can. So one caffeinated drink a day and no decaf.
Thank you, Kate. And if you have any questions, let us know. You can email, as I've said, talkfertility@gmail.com. You can also get in touch with us on our socials. I'm @fertilitypoddy on Instagram and Twitter.
And I'm yourfertilityjourney on Instagram and fertjourney on Twitter.
Make sure you join us next week.